expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
All right. Welcome back to another edition of Punkonomics with Dr. Benjamin Balick, Jose Galvez, and myself, Jesse Velez. And guys,
And Corey Carroll.
And Corey Carroll is on his way.
Almost circling the area like a buzzard looking for parking.
Apparently, parking is tricky right now. No.
Very tricky. But Jose is an athletic, young, bike riding.
Yeah.
Fat beep.
Yeah.
Well, try putting another 10 years on top of yours.
doesn't get any better, does it?
No.
Well, it gets tricky, especially here. It definitely was worst in Colorado, where you still have all the infrastructure, but like 2 feet of snow are outside. It's cold.
Hey.
But here you have to worry about all sorts of traffic because, it's way trickier to bike around here.
Yeah, actually, I believe Orlando was kind of elected by whoever elects these sort of things.
Whoever got the payoff.
Yeah.
No, not in this case, perhaps. It's the worst, or maybe one of the worst pedestrian cities.
Oh, there you go. I agree to that.
They don't elect them. They count, number of incidents. And Orlando got one of the worst scores.
Right, in the nation. They just passed a law recently that the pedestrians have the right of way.
Really?
Yeah. No, this is no joke.
They not always had that right here.
That's one of the things that really shocked me when I came back from being in San Francisco for so long. Because over there, being a tourist, if you don't, if you jaywalk or, you just don't give somebody the right of way, the local people right away let you know. Yeah, it's crazy. Mm. But over here, I still see people actually saying to cars, so yeah, go ahead,
Yeah.
Well, it's safer,
Yeah,
it's
of course.
A little bit like, the old movie, the old and new, right? The Death Race 2000. Here's some highbrow culture. Of course, the recent one with the ever sexy, Jason Statham, right? Frankly not... it's what it is. Fine, whatever.
He did redo that, didn't he?
With what's his name? The guy from Kung Fu, right? Carradine.
David Carradine.
And one of the first, I believe, non-porn role
of David Carradine. Yeah.
of Rambo.
That's right. That's right.
Old git that I am.
Stallone.
He was brilliant in it. He was wonderful. This was so funny. Dark humor, right? It's all about a race where you actually... And it's completely humoristic, that movie, which I believe is late 70s. I can IMDb it, but...
Mm-hmm.
He was very ironic, kind of stupid. I remember as a kid when it came out, it was so naughty, the notion of, driving stupid fiberglass kind of over-the-top cars into people getting points. Murderous... mayhem, basically.
Well, you don't have to go too far for that. You can go to Biffalo here. And, they still, hardcore big engines, big exhaust, whole bit. Hey, there's Corey.
That long? You're lucky.
There you go.
Or maybe it parked illegally.
Uh-oh.
We enforce that law around here.
Excuse me, okay, there's a car in Mills Lawn right now. We need to do something about
it. It's close.
I've been close to that, though, sometimes, and half the parking's closed for work, just in the worst, most possible, when what grades are due. It happened once that I was eyeing that green. What'll happen? I just park the car in the middle.
Let's put it this way. It looks like a legitimate spot, but it seems too good to be true.
I see.
Where is it? And I can let you know.
It's down by the Cornell Art Museum.
Uh-huh.
And there's just a bunch of spots there.
It could be. There's no signs, right?
It's facing the lake.
I didn't see a sign.
Okay, then you're fine.
What can they do anyways? They're going to give me a ticket. I'm just going to, I'm not a student anymore. I'm just going to chuck it.
Right. I don't know what jurisdiction
they'll put a boot.
That's a good question. Can you get a city ticket in parking at Rollins?
Whatever.
It transfer up? I don't know.
It's an old game. Many campuses have this whole parking catastrophe situation, and us too. Some schools literally ban all student parking. It's no student shall ever park anywhere on this campus.
Right. It's almost medieval.
There's that. There's schools like that out there. And here, honestly, again, it's a little bit nice. And even the security, I don't know. I hope it's not cool if I say it, but I say it in a positive way that, if it's reasonable and you explain and,
Yeah.
They look at you as an individual, right? That's
I don't know, man. I'd rather fight. I gave up on cars at this point in my life. I'm like sick of using the same 100-year-old technology.
I drove here from Jacksonville. I needed to leave earlier.
That's a long
ride
bike,
bike
ride. That's a really long bike ride.
fun scenic route right there.
I miss. I wasn't able to listen in.
No, we were just messing around. I mean, we're going to go here and there and everywhere as usual. And since you're here, also, I mean, you know, give us whatever updates you feel like giving us. And you guys were talking a little. Well, before we talked a little bit about the election, you guys were filling me up because I haven't seen a thing. I'm in complete.
Did you guys see the coin flip thing?
Yeah, I was. Yes, that was on my very short list. I love it. I love it. So let's. Yeah, tell us.
I mean, so there were 12 districts. Or last I heard, there are 12 districts in Iowa decided by a coin flip, and Hillary won like 10 of them, or something crazy like
that.
Vast
majority. Yeah, the statistics don't.
Wow.
How many times did they throw the Hillary coin?
The great
was it like 2 out of 3 type of flip
what
of
the
coin?
Ratio? All of them or a lot of? No,
it's like
the
vast majority.
But you know what? I gotta say, Bernie won.
Yeah, no, Bernie won.
To be able to get to that point with somebody like Hillary, who's already been down that road, and I mean, let's face it, she's a strong candidate.
Although I heard that for the presidential elections, instead of flipping coins there and giving you ballots to choose a presidential candidate, you're gonna get a tic-tac-toe game.
There you go. We'll let a chicken play it.
Actually, you know, I didn't even have time to read the details. Hence, I'm asking the follow-up questions and stuff of how many. But I saw it kind of in my feed coming from actually a couple of my. My Facebook friends and people I've followed over the years, some of whom, let's just say, I mean, Doug Henwood is like wrote literally the book against Hillary. I mean, the book that got all the establishment Democrats' panties in a knot. I mean, so he's like, there's like wanted signs of him. And he's been my favorite podcast since before podcasting, literally. I find him, he's done this, you know, this kind of a journal, you know, non-academic level, but in-depth, alternative views, open-minded, you know, socialist, libertarian. For 30 years already, yeah. But anyway, when he posted that, my comment was that you know, I was a little disappointed at the Democrats a little bit because you know, Karl Rove, the architect, as he's called by his friends, was so much more elegant when rigging elections in 2000, 2004, and 2008. No, 2008 didn't work. It's not his fault. It's not his fault.
So late last night, I was watching Bloomberg because that's one of the few stations I'll actually watch for news. And they were discussing the importance of Iowa and like who actually wins Iowa. It really doesn't matter. It's not a statistically significant predictor for either parties, you know, to see whether or not they'll go on to be the candidate. But apparently what's important is where a candidate starts before Iowa and where they finish Iowa. So from that perspective, actually, the two big winners there were Bernie by a huge margin, right?
I tell you, no.
And then Rubio.
I'm excited.
Rubio.
Marco Rubio, right?
Marco Rubio was the other big winner.
Yeah, that's kind of odd, too.
Well, that'd be an interesting. First of all, I do think that what you said is right. I mean, that he's already won in the sense he did what he can do, frankly, for this election. And I'm concerned, as usual, with people who think that he can do much more.
I think
he's changed the rhetoric.
I think he's a legitimate candidate, though.
Yeah, he's.
Bernie. Yeah. 6 months ago, I would have said he's not a legitimate candidate in that I genuinely didn't think he has a chance of getting elected. And I know where you're coming from.
It's
from
another
Ben.
Obama.
I'm not sure about
maybe
that.
Maybe not.
No.
He deserves a little bit more credit for his record. You
I
know,
personally
that he's more,
think of Hillary more as like another...
Yeah, Hillary's another Obama.
Yes,
he's
yes.
more like establishment Democrat.
Worse,
yeah.
frankly.
Such as Obama.
Yeah.
Just like, let's
give but I mean, at this point, even if he doesn't win, you know, people are more aware now about the issues that's, you know, nationwide, not just one little pocket, that hopefully they'll, you know, push their representatives to do some changes.
I think that one of the things that really kind of like makes me think about it is let's suppose that Bernie Sanders does win the primary and let's suppose that he's running for president, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Let's suppose he runs into presidential debates, right? And let's pick one of the three on the other side, right? Either Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, or Trump, right? Do you think that the rhetoric Bernie is using is factual enough to be able to to fight against the monster that's been developed on the other side.
I think that
like demagogy.
I think what he's bringing to the table is factual, but the fact that he's talking in layman terms and he is addressing the question straight on instead of doing this. Okay, so what happened to your emails? Well, you know, I was at this place and they told me I can use them. You know, I mean, not really directing the issues, you know, with answers, with clear answers. Mm-hmm. It's not happening, I don't think, on the Hillary side. But Bernie is much more kind of like your next door neighbor telling you, hey, you know, the house next door is, you know, burning down or something's going on. And you will believe it because he's more like you than... establish.
I guess kind of my point comes out of what I have been reading on, say, economists talking on the topic, right? And I wanted to bring up how you have kind of this split among center, really, what is center mainstream economists and more lefty economists about the topic, right? You have people like Robert Reich, if you're not familiar with whom that is Inequality for All. It's a documentary on Netflix on inequality. We were talking about it a couple of weeks ago. In the show,
He teaches at Berkeley.
And he's obviously supporting Bernie Sanders.
The guy who quit Clinton because Clinton started to...
Robert Reich, he was a labor... He's not an economist, I think. I think he's a political scientist,
He's a professor at UC Berkeley.
Yeah, at Berkeley,
but
right?
He does a lot of economics,
right?
Maybe that's why he gets the economist right.
Yeah.
The economics right.
Because he's not an economist.
And then you have people like Paul Krugman, right, who are arguing that although Bernie Sanders present a promising alternative, that most of his policies lack a substantive fundamental background.
Well,
don't shoot the messenger. I'm not agreeing with anybody.
At the same time,
Krugman is basically saying is, hey, Hillary is someone who will pragmatically get stuff done, right?
Okay.
And he will, and she will be able to get, like, at least a loaf of bread. What Reich is basically replying is, hey, what you haven't gotten is that the bakery is owned by someone else.
Let me pose this. Hillary was asked a very straight on and serious question, okay? And it had to do with her changing her stance on different issues. You know, I don't have a problem with that because I understand that any candidate that comes in that's trying to become president, it's not going to have all the knowledge in the world or all the experience in the world, you know, or even the right answers. And I look at Bernie Sanders that way as well as Hillary. So it just really depends on the perception of the general public, whether they actually buy what they're selling. Because let's be honest, this little group here understands economics, but does the rest of the population in the United States that do?
Does it matter? This is theater. The one problem, the only thing that makes me kind of lean towards Bernie Sanders is everything he did before he ran for office. I'm looking at his record, you know? The same reason why I did not like Obama's policies, even though his promises sounded good at the time, but his background in terms of his other activities and his career didn't.
But I will have to say that.
But what they say is, nothing.
Going back to the question from a few minutes ago, is like, how would Sanders square up against what's going to come from the Republican Party?
Not only that, right? Like, but think of him as like being president, like say 2 years from now, with the agenda he has proposed right now,
let's go one at a time. Right? How does he square up? So generally, you know, the last couple of decades, they've said that elections in the United States are won in the center, right? I would say that if you had Sanders, and let's just say for hypothetically you had Trump on the other side, right? So we move to two extremes within the U.S. political spectrum. In that case, I don't think it's actually one in the center. I think it becomes about voter turnout. I'm just trying to call this like I'm calling the Super Bowl, right? It's just how many Republicans turn out to vote, how many Democrats come out to vote, and which side is better at rigging the election in their favor, right? That's the candidate that wins. To your point, if someone like Sanders was elected, could he be effective? I would tend to agree with you, you know, despite his track record, despite what he wants to do, his best intentions, it's what Congress will let him do.
Exactly.
And beyond the Congress, and, like the hand
and
the
that's
Congress,
what boils
where
right.
the power resides.
And that's a really token, real argument, because like Hillary, in that sense, does have, in the pragmatic center economy's view, right? Mm. Like Paul Krugman, Hillary has a better record of achieving this type of
well, yeah, but that's also because
than
I mean,
what Bernie would be able to do.
She's
and,
well,
she's
you know,
a
you know, all I have to say is
yeah, that's why she's so popular among the same people who support.
I agree with Corey. I mean, it doesn't matter whether Bernie Sanders or you know a magician wins the presidency. they can only get so much done. And that's pending on Congress. But then AI. At the same time, if you're questioning whether Bernie is able to do something within the next 2 years and all that, the only question that I can pose to you is like, can we do better than George W. Bush? I think so. So
yeah, we could do better than a lot, but we're not. We're just doing worse and worse because we're right. not realizing we have to change the game.
Right.
It's adaptation. You know,
and,
we
and
have
that,
to adapt
deal,
to different
like,
conditions.
With Bernie, right? Like he's actually effectively proposing to change.
Well, but hold on there. Something that Corey said and what I was saying, I mean, really kind of, I don't know, give me an idea. Because you said in the American spectrum that Trump is like one extreme and Sanders is the other. I think not. And that links, I mean, all of what you're thinking, the things that you were saying, sorry. Maybe if he, I always say, oh, if he drops the Democrats with momentum and say, okay, enough of the nonsense, I'm going back to independent, I'd be happy. If he actually seeks out some kind of independent-minded right-winger
really
for the ticket as a vice president, let's say, I'd be enthusiastically voting for him, not just voting for him. But what about another option, though, I don't know if he could do it without what I just said, is that he really does go to the other extreme a little, that he does
sure.
adapt his campaign, assuming he gets through the Democrats, right? Now he is a Democratic candidate, right? Or he dropped the Democrat. I don't know. If he does that, he probably destroys the Democrats, which I'm not shedding a tear. Remember our principle on this show of equal opportunity
really
hate.
Exactly.
You know, wow,
exactly.
We haven't mentioned that, yes? But the Trump of the left, if you will... is he could do that, maybe. I don't know if it's his nature. It's a different animal, but imagine somebody who's seeking out the populism, seeking out the anger, right? Like Trump is using the age-old fascistic, you know, anybody with different skin color, the good old, hate the poor, hate
right,
the people
right.
don't like, look like you, and above all, blame them for all the stuff you messed up. So, you know, it's old, we have it in the Old Testament, it's Bronze Age Jewish tradition, scapegoating, right? And it's actually in postmodern philosophy, recognizes in Jacques Derrida in particular as one of the most important mechanisms of political social discourse. Scapegoating, you know, you know. Once my ancient people back in the Bronze Age, once a year, they kind of cursed. They put all the bad karma onto the goat and pushed it off a cliff. You know, not very nice, but very effective nonetheless. Everybody felt great about themselves. Went home, had a party. Life is good. Nothing much has changed under the sun. Oh my God, I'm quoting scripture again. Yeah, it's funny sometimes. I freak my students out all the time with it. But imagine him going there, you know, starting maybe things like hatred of the rich. I mean, I'm on purpose going to stuff that I'm not particularly comfortable
well,
with personally.
It's kind of tricky, though, to us. At the same time, like, you could argue, isn't he already kind of doing, maybe not towards the
well,
hatred side.
I don't think he's
hooking rationally. Look at how you guys
but
were talking.
Hear me
he's
out.
Having real
like,
statistics.
Like,
he's giving real analysis. He's doing the real, he's talking about the real issues. I'm saying, what if he starts moving away from perhaps the real issues and start focusing on the emotional
I don't know if that strategy
hooks.
Would work because the real issues actually are appealing, very appealing to younger
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that dimension of this conflict we haven't talked about.
I don't think the way he's
right?
conveying the
mm-hmm.
message is like that. What I think he's doing is for older people, the people in my generation, we're looking at that as like this is what we were talking about in the 60s, then it'll be done. You know, finally somebody's coming out and saying something, and the younger people are going like, yeah, this is the way we can change things.
This is the only rational line.
No, but here's what I'm saying. If you went with your strategy, I mean, so far with
I'm
Hillary.
I'm not advocating too, by the way.
But I'm just saying, but so far with Hillary, with the whole email scandal, right? Hmm. He's taken the high road, and I actually think that that's played
right.
really well for him.
Yeah.
So for him to reverse I don't know that would play so well. But a really interesting outcome could be, just as a hypothetical, you could have Sanders run as an independent, say Cruz gets the Republican nomination, and you have Trump run as an independent. And honestly, I have no idea how that would really shake out. No clue.
It would hurt both parties.
It would hold. It would be so fragmented.
I raise my tea bottle.
Now you brought up something about him taking the high road. Mm-hmm. And I watched the debates where he's actually been doing it every single time without letting go of his position when it comes to the differences between him and Hillary. I don't know if you're getting that feeling that they've already talked it out. It's kind of like, well, if you don't win, then you can become my vice president and vice versa.
I don't think that's going on. I don't see that.
I would like that to be the case to some extent.
When you compare other Democratic debates in the past, we're talking about like, they're slinging out mud left and right, you know, just like the Republicans.
I think Sanders
is just very calm and professional.
I genuinely think that Sanders is just taking a different tact. And I think on the other
side...
But
even Hillary's doing the same thing.
Yeah, but I think Hillary is probably cognizant of the fact that Bernie has this kind of growing... Or I'm sorry, Sanders has this growing core.
Right.
If she were to lash out and attack it, she probably thinks that she runs the risk of actually inflaming it and making it larger.
I agree.
And losing, you know, and almost in a way, she might appear to be like a Republican in a way, right? Because the Republicans have kind of developed a reputation for the mudslinging in the last couple elections. So maybe she's afraid of painting herself kind of, you know, the wrong way.
Now, here's a question for you guys, because, you know, obviously we're talking more on the local level and all that, but let's take it on the national side. There seems to be a lot of differences on, you know, Hillary and Bernie, and mostly I take the position of Bernie. I mean, I've always been anti-war, you know, maybe it's my generation, you know, we're living in a bubble, whatever, but it seems like Hillary's coming across as like, okay, I'm hawkish, whatever, you know, if somebody messes with us, we're going to cut some heads and then we'll talk about...
She has a record for it.
Yeah, she has a record for it.
She's as much of a war criminal as George W. Bush.
Versus Bernie, his attitude is that, okay, unless there's something really crucial that we need to do, you know, let's talk about it, you know, and come to general consensus. War does not pay. I mean, we've learned that.
I wish Jay Gordon wasn't here and instead is working some, you know, minimum wage labor about that. But you should understand that, you know, a lot of people, the real left in America, is criticizing, and I think productively, Sanders for the many, many, many giant compromises he's already made.
Right.
I've defended him sometimes a little bit like that, and saying that if he's going to play this game, he's got to play this
game. But on a global scale, you know.
So militaristic, by the way, one of the main problems of Sanders, that he is absolutely not anti-empire, nowhere near the degree that like the libertarians
are. And that's why I'm getting that. Do you think that our influence in the world would change with a Sanders administration? I mean, considerably to where we would probably be moving back like the British did, you know, start, you know, giving away whatever we have, or do you think that he would maintain the status quo?
You know how the British lost their empire?
Well,
World War II.
Yeah. Of course.
They had no intention and no inclination, and there's plenty of more Indians for them to murder.
And particularly right now, like, let's say, you know, oil. I mean, the market is being flooded left and right. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, obviously it's going to come to a point where we're going to have to say what's going on.
You know, the interesting thing is we're kind of all glossing over a larger topic, which is trade volumes, right? Mm-hmm. What's actually being shipped on the sea is plummeting. So we're kind of entering this into this era of de facto economic nationalism, right? Where, you know, the United States, we don't import as much oil as we used to. And by the time our domestic production starts to trail off, we'll be well on our way to electric vehicles. It kind of becomes, that aspect of trade becomes irrelevant. And it's not just us, it becomes irrelevant around the world. So now you're just kind of down to agricultural trade, which in terms of volumes is, you know, it's pretty low. Most developed nations are relatively food independent. So, you know, if you don't really need anything from abroad, what's the point of an empire?
Right.
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 And it doesn't just become the case for us. It's increasingly becoming the case for a lot of developed countries.
I think that there is still one reason, and it's not commodity based. I think it has to do with finance.
Yeah.
Because you can hide money away.
Yeah.
And those are trade volumes. And I mean, like, that 1% that's messing all of income inequality stats and stuff like that, a lot of that money is not in the United States, it's abroad, and true. You it's still need some sort
but,
you know, of...
But progressively getting quashed, though, because, like, I mean, China has probably been the most, honestly, effective of this if you look at where they were 10 years ago and where you look at where they are today, right?
Mm-hmm. In what sense?
People who are trying to move China money out of China illegally, all right, without being taxed, they're increasingly having to do so in very desperate ways. They're having to do things like moving entire cargo vessels with empty containers, but they say that there is actually
something in
the
containers. China has always had like a very militaristic way of, I mean, just I was just listening to another thing on their birth control, right? And the role that government plays in monitoring a lot of activities in China is not quite comparable to many other places, but think of Russia for a second, right?
Well, yeah, but Russia's
and
a small
money
economy.
Coming
though.
Out of Russia being hidden, right? Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
We're
like,
talking.
Hey, it matters to still have an empire.
They're a tax haven now, Russia. In the
yeah,
sense.
The, like, I mean, like,
but
they,
I mean,
that
it's
matters.
A really it's a small country. Look at the large economies, right? Look at the United States. Look at China. Look at Japan. Right. Start going down the list in terms of actual GDP, right? The United States, it's easier to almost hide money domestically. Right in a variety of tax vehicles than it is to necessarily take it offshore because
well,
I
America
mean,
has always been much harder.
Increasingly,
than Europe,
the yeah, IRS yeah. is kind of cracking down on that. In the European Union, there are tremendous pressures to like say yeah. you know deny Luxembourg basically what it has, which is it's a tax haven, right? It's a corporate yeah. tax haven.
Well, they're you know, desperate because they're talking what right. like 1.5 to 2 trillion yeah. euro or something. I don't know the numbers. Nobody exactly knows, of course. But one of the things that the Europeans did in their big push for eliminate tax evasion in the past few years is hit the little rich,
right?
So mm-hmm. and so it's a fraction of. What we're talking—it's not. They're not even scratching at the surface of what their goal is. It becomes politicized again. Oh, so the labor will say, you know, oh, look yeah. at the Tories. They allow the billionaires to hide their money. We won't do so. So they nail somebody who saved after life's work $1 million.
Yeah,
they nailed it.
But like you know, you look at the European Union. They're trying to homogenize their banking laws, right? Mm-hmm. And to a degree, their tax code. That's why the UK is threatening to just leave. Right, mm-hmm. because of they are a banking haven. So I mean, yeah, you do have this pushback, but I mean, the trend is towards kind of eliminating tax havens.
Mm. Let's turn it back to Bernie.
Yeah.
Bernie administration. Okay, he's talking about bringing back the I can't remember the names of the laws, but Glass something.
Glass-Steagall.
Right, mm-hmm. and the other one is to turn over. The one where they make people corporations or corporations
oh,
people.
Oh, that was the Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah,
right.
the specific.
Right.
I mean, it's a whole series of it.
Now,
it's another thing.
Don't you think that's going to change a lot of the way we deal with the economy here?
You know, Glass-Steagall basically, I'll tell you what Glass-Steagall will do. It'll probably result in a more stable financial system, not more or less overnight. I mean, there'll be some instability as things have to be moved around. And it'll probably accelerate job losses in finance because banks will essentially become utilities, mm-hmm. right? That's where they're moving anyways, but reinstating Glass-Steagall will just accelerate that. On the Citizens United thing, I don't know if there's actually a legal basis. I mean, I wish there was to overturn that, but I don't even know how you could
And it will
start
have a marginal effect, people, again. That's actually, I've seen back in the day when I was still, back in the day, right? when I was still reading carefully things. a little off. It's a symbolic thing. I mean, the Citizens United is a nasty aberration, and a violation of the. It's disgusting. But if you stop it tomorrow, reverse it tomorrow, which is not easy, like Corey said already, yeah. the impact will be marginal at best. Because okay, so it's a little bit more expensive to buy politicians then. So, but still, it's very affordable. Our politicians are actually. Really cheap when you consider, right? The highest rate of return ever recorded by that estimate a few years
right,
back of 22,000%.
Like yeah.
That is to me like one of the strangest things about like economics as a social science or like a discipline, you know? Like how is it that once you actually get to like regulatory capture on topics of corruption and buying politicians, which are the norm nowadays on how many businesses are becoming larger,
mm-hmm.
economists are surprisingly silent. We don't have like that many.
Well, that's because unfortunately mainstream economists, they kind of have to serve the status quo in order to keep
it. No, of course, but even like in the heterodoxy level, like I failed to read up on the map, who is taking seriously how much money does the United States in those measurements you were talking like GDP,
that's,
right? Are becoming lost because of this
problem. It's actually a very important point, I think, because I think what's happening here, that because mainstream economics is well pushed towards the right wing generally, so it kind of misrepresents the opinion of general economists, certainly the population, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, when Paul Krugman, many people think of him as a socialist.
A lefty,
well, actually, he is a center-right, if anything, you know, if anything.
He was doing trade models, right?
And and even later, okay, you are allowed to, you know, okay, change your mind and stuff, but he didn't really change his mind. He's just a reasonable center-right kind of Reaganistic, I would call him almost, economist. Fine. But what's happening, I think, is that most of the heterodoxy, those who are not in the mainstream, right? So it's a minority. Are lefties of one flavor or another. I know because I happen to be, there are not a lot of people like me that have like, that honestly have like communist friends and a libertarian, people I personally respect and follow their opinion and sometimes scratch my head all night going like, whoa, maybe I'm wrong about something pretty fundamental. So I happen to have that opportunity to hang out with libertarians, despite not being a libertarian myself, and vice versa. And they are the only ones who really have a tradition on that stuff, because they have been criticizing government, right? And if you want to study the corruption of government, as is, and it is our, you know, the corruption of government, of course, involves big business. It's I shouldn't say it, but maybe I should, right?
But
the libertarians
like
have it, and we don't want, and we don't mix.
So the
we don't mix.
Don't
right?
mix.
So
I feel like the problem though is that the libertarians, they're the only ones that really have a view on it, but their view is strictly quantitative.
It's not necessary.
It's more government versus less government. I see very, very, very little from the libertarians.
No, right,
about,
in the popular,
about
right.
quantitative yeah. governance.
What?
Qualitative. Sorry. Qualitative.
On qualitative.
I see very little from the libertarians on right. qualitative.
It's really hard in like their defense. That's so hard. Oh my
it
God.
Is hard.
Like public choice is one example, I think, that Austrians, like if you read Hayek, he's actually anti-quantitative, right? And he's very adamant about the problem of government as like an information problem. And this is literally what you have here. For as much as I'm not an Austrian economist, I actually think Hayek is kind of right on this point, right? In the sense that the main problem government faces everywhere is an asymmetric information problem, meaning, hey, government can never acquire the information necessary to satisfy everybody at once.
So at a certain point, you got to almost start to wonder if this isn't like a thermodynamic outcome, right?
Yeah.
Whereas something gets larger, the inefficiencies scale.
Mm-hmm. And the problem, right, is not that, like, I personally think that the real big problem also, and this is from gender economics, right, is a similar, like, what they call is a separability problem, right, where feminist economists have been criticizing, like, say, for example, with informal work, you cannot separate what's a firm and what's a household as an economic agent, so supply and demand are one
working,
same good.
They're producing
are
at
the
home
same,
as well
they
as
are producers and consumers. In this context, you have a similar problem at the macro level, where you have large corporations and you have government playing the same song. So it's a separability problem in which you don't really know which one is ruling, which one is producing, right? Although they are supposed to have separate capabilities and they're designed for separate purposes in society, you can't separate them as cleanly. So analysis on them is incredibly ambiguous. It's kind of basically telling you, hey, try to understand economics, but now your supply is your demand and your demand is your supply.
Right.
Right? It's incredibly difficult
it's illegal.
To make sense
it's
of
a
this.
Jurisprudence issue. It reminds me of the reforms that were done in the 70s in anticipation of the Thatcher-Reagan, mostly known by their name, reforms of the 80s. Part of it was antitrust or elimination, more or less, thereof, slowly, or at least starting the process to eliminate most of antitrust. And the principle of antitrust as per se or not, right? So the 60s in America, just because you're big. Oh, yeah, but I'm super efficient, and in my technology, I'm Intel. It's actually good to be really big, even if I'm monopolistic. And maybe I'm using that special example because I kind of tend to think maybe in this case it's true, the argument that I'm saying for Intel here.
Mm-hmm.
They stop the per se, you know? Oh, if you're more than this percentage of the general market, you got to break up. And then it became now into these extremely complex arguments that can never survive court. You know? So whenever merger of acquisition comes, the Federal Trade Commission comes along to sue it, to say, wait a minute, this is going to be monopoly power. It's extremely difficult to make a convincing and robust argument that, yes, this is clearly going to be detrimental to all. So it passes. So it's part of all this kind of trend. Maybe it's necessary to have per se. You know, maybe it's necessary to be paranoid about the separation of business and government. You know, even at least once you're developed, because as anybody who knows, you absolutely have to have a very heavy-handed guiding hand of government in order to develop, in order to industrialize. Right, yeah. Nobody's done it without it.
And it's surprising, like, right, like most like Latin America underdeveloped countries, right, like, have a conflictive situation with government, right? Because on one hand, like, most of the largest corporations are being already regulatory captured, many of those governments, so they get special treatments and stuff like that.
Which is the term, by the way. It's a very important term, right? I mean, yeah. Regulatory capture, right?
Regulatory capture.
You get the government to do your
business, right? The government, basically, you have a monopoly, and the government funds extra barriers of entry. Yeah, for you.
Protect you from competition.
Protect you from competition, right? And the logic is, right, it's a very mainstream economics logic that if you have big monopolies, what you're going to allow is for these big monopolies to encourage innovation. And innovation is technically good for growth. But that argument is flawed because most of the largest innovation leaps are not done by the private sector, right? So really, it's kind of this bogus argument.
The leaps,
are
right. I mean, then afterwards, the private sector in the best
private
of
sector
the world
distributes
then,
the innovation, right? But the big leaps are not being developed by... So it's literally a distributive conflict.
And this is, again, an important point that we haven't mentioned, I think, in at least a number of months. Mm-hmm. So this notion, again, it's a bit of a misconception, but the data is complete absolute about this. The majority of technological innovation is indeed done by government. In America, certainly.
Yeah.
And in most Western developed countries too, all of them actually.
Three of our favorite examples, I think, is like microchips, the internet, and turbines.
Oh, and how about anything in the nuclear sciences?
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah.
Splitting the atom.
And people forget that before you can come up with, you know, the very invaluable and important job that people like, you know, the iconic Steve Jobs did to create the iPhone, let's say, right, that important contribution. In economic terms, really, it's just the last stage, the last couple of percentages. People forget that how do you make an electronic device? Where do you get the power? Transistor radios, computers, metal. Once you break it down, you realize this is all funded by National Science Foundation, probably.
Done by Blangrand University.
Subsidized
research.
By the government in public schools. Mm. And you can go on with that. A lot of, again, that's very challenging to teach sometimes, how you can go back. And so where did that engineer go to school? You know, and who built it? Mm-hmm. You know, and who paid for it?
Well, it's kind of funny because, look at the model that Google's taken recently, right? They have their core businesses. Yeah. And then they basically try to hire really smart people and they tell them to do research without really any end to making a profit, mm-hmm. right? And Wall Street has criticized them for a while until they finally just recently decided to shut up, mm. right? And that's what the public sector has, you know, done for decades, if not centuries, mm. right? Nuclear fission is a great example. You had really smart people. They said, we have an idea. We need to do the fundamental research. There's no money in this. Mm-hmm. But we can change the world, possibly.
And one of the things that you have to consider, right, is like Google is still, like, in general, servers, right? Like search servers.
Their two core businesses are search and then YouTube.
Like taken into account that these people are supplying a public good, right? In the most intense definition of the sense of a public good, it's not rivalrous, it's not exclusive. Mm-hmm. Anybody can go on their phone and
de facto,
search something Google.
I guess
the only deal is that public good is funded privately. So you can look at ads in Google as a taxing mechanism to support that public good, which is using that server, right? Research in general has been considered always a public good. Mm-hmm. The question is, why do we keep on believing that this monopolistic non-competitors really, but the monopolistically behaved firms, large corporations, are actually going to create the innovations we want through allowing them this type of regulatory capture? right?
I think what it is that that position just becomes very easy to defend in the mainstream discourse because of, you
the
know,
amount of money.
No. Because I mean, here, look, I'm holding an iPhone, right? Jesus. It's got Apple branded on it. Now, to like the layman, who remembers having the big car phone in the early 90s made by Motorola, he sees Apple as delivering the quote unquote innovation, right? The downsizing. That's because, I mean, that's an easy argument to present. So that's why, that's why the big corporations, they get the credit, right? Mm-hmm. It's because of the tangible is delivered by them.
The distributive aspect, yeah. Right? I think we're talking about like a very similar deal. I guess kind of where I would like to go with this is kind of returning to what does this say as to the problem with the split in the left right now, in which you see one candidate who's to some extent or another attempting and at trying to take a hit at this structural systemic problem, this regulatory capture problem, right? Where Bernie's saying, hey, we got to get money out of politics. We got to reduce the size of corporations. We got to protect labor. We got to control this systemic structural beast that has gone out of hand. And then you have Hillary, who surprisingly is incredibly quiet about this problem.
Yeah, it's because she's not actually on the left.
Exactly.
Well,
right?
I'm wondering why she's not getting calls from Goldman Sachs and places like that saying, hey, Hillary, get a little
sure
red. We need you a little red now, please, because...
They don't need to call.
We don't have a Republican.
They win anyway. I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, either they. For now, I do think that still the chances of something has to be done. If you guys are right, and Sanders is really potentially poised to make real structural change in America.
No, I didn't say that.
Hallelujah.
I said he's poised to get elected.
Don't shoot the messenger, man.
I said he could get elected. Okay. There's a big difference between getting elected and getting anything
right,
done.
Right, yeah. So even getting elected. Yeah, and then we keep forgetting. It's amazing. It's a little bit like those slips of the mind that you mentioned that we can't help ourselves to think that Steve Jobs did that entire phone. We don't even think about the engineers.
Yeah.
Let alone all the
Chinese
labor.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of bizarre because Wozniak actually designed the iPhone and all that kind of stuff.
The Woz man.
And ironically enough, he stands in line with everybody else to go and buy one.
Well,
by the way, I'm not incredibly
Steve Jobs
impressed
as being a purely blah blah guy who didn't do a lot.
No.
It's possible to make.
It's been
that
25 critique. Years since we have cell phones. By now, I was literally expecting like a holographic vision in my pupils or something.
They exist.
Like
it's actually right up in.
No,
Altamonte
they exist.
Springs.
But I wanted AT&T to provide it to me for $100 a month.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed.
In Japan, some stores already have the Retina. It categorizes their customers. So they know what they like to buy and all that kind of stuff, and they walk in and there's particular shops where they actually recognize the face and they already have a whole lineup of products ready to sell the person.
Yeah.
So we're not too far away.
No, there's a world. I mean, let me say...
Not time-wise, but...
The coolest technology in the world is coming up out next year. I mean, there's no argument about the coolest technology like in many years.
Well, that is Oculus?
No, Oculus is now... Facebook bought it. Everything Facebook buys or touches turns to you-know-what, yes?
Yes.
I'm finally literally removing all their applications from my mobile devices. I will just use a browser. Enough. No. I'm really kind of angry, and I think I have to get them out of my classes, too. I'm done. Facebook. Why am I even talking about Facebook? I shouldn't even mention
them. No, coolest technology. I said Oculus, so what are you going with?
Oculus is going to be granny VR, right?
Yeah.
By definition, a little bit.
Okay.
Steam.
Oh, Steam?
Steam VR. It's coming out. It's about 100 times more powerful than anything.
It's Steam is a...
Everything they do is always works flawlessly.
That's they're behind you. Did you ever play Counter-Strike as a kid?
No, are you kidding me? Steam is going to bury the entertainment divisions of Sony and Microsoft. The only reason they even exist are network effects. Because you have buddies that play on Xbox, you gotta keep your Xbox. There's absolutely no reason not to run a Steam box.
They got the Halo franchise.
Ah, okay. So they have one of those kind of keys.
They still have some of, like, you know, core games.
A couple of core games. All right. So it's a kind of a network effect.
They're designing virtual reality?
No, they're making a controller, including a 15x15 foot, serious resolution with a response time suitable for gaming, and the kind of, and they say that they're going to do it all for less than $500.
For less than $500.
With,
now we're talking.
Two-handed, you know, multi-dimensional controllers. It's all included.
Yeah.
And 15 square, four cubes, you know, like those robot thingies, but
you're telling me is that even like this video game was even also like an innovation funded by
I already own program. Games that use it. It's already there. I mean, there's SDKs out for a while. The thing is that they're tuning it. There are games that are already being designed specifically for VR, because essentially you have to establish the language of VR, right? I mean, we don't know what works, what doesn't, and how. I mean, it's a new art form, basically, or a new version of an art form. So we don't really know what works, what doesn't. There's going to be obvious duds and stupid things will happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's quite exciting, at least from an entertaining value. It's coming from somebody who never has time to play, but, you know, at least I can
imagine. I want holograms, man. I'm excited
about holograms. Company, and I was saying this earlier, it's called Magic Leap. They're up in, it's either Altamonte Springs, maybe Maitland, I don't know. It's
Magic Leap? No, what
they? Magic Leap, yeah. They raised about $500 million in venture capital. About $300 million came from Google, and then I think Intel,
and
Microsoft,
doing VR.
So no. They have a technology. Google. I don't know if you guys know this. Google killed their glass project.
Really?
Yeah. Ah, the glass. Of course. No, Google I thought glass. Cardboard is the cool Google project.
Oh
no.
Well, okay. Well, and
glass was for wankers.
Cardboard.
From day one.
Cardboard.
Day three.
Cardboard will disappear.
The minute we saw it, it was over.
So, magically, their technology is basically it'll be a pair of eyeglasses that projects a hologram in front of you, and not just like a normal sketchy like Star Wars. 1970s like hollow chest. No, we're talking about real, like ultra high definition holograms.
But they project the holograms, you look at them through the glasses.
But actually, the technology, it is they use lasers that track your retina and it goes directly into your eyes.
So you're basically writing like an old CRT screens. You're just doing a picture, like, you know, I mean, where you draw line by line, basically, like the old TVs before LCDs, right? For the older, not that old.
Being done with a laser.
Yeah, I remember that technology has been around. Yeah, and it's been around for a good number of years, theoretically, but you're saying they're beginning to get to the point where they think they might have a consumer product. Very interesting, yeah. Though, you know, as a guy who's thought about it a lot over the years, and older, first generation geek, right? So the technology is not always the most important thing. You know, I haven't upgraded from HD, HD yet in a gaming. I have a very nice screen, but it's HD. It's 28 inch. It's just roughly at the right distance where I don't see the pixelation. You know, of course now the real nuts are doing, you know, multi 4K screens all around you. You know, and the cards, some of those, you know, $1,000.
Yeah,
not even Titans is like tip of C now. You know, it's like the new 980s, you know, the overclocked stuff. They can do that remarkably.
Can't believe I'm saying this. You're actually more of a nerd than I am.
It's almost an overkill. Honestly, how you write the game, the gameplay. Yeah. Video games are no longer a gadget gimmick. They are a mature form of art.
And sure.
Don't ask me, ask the Met, you know, ask art experts. Yeah. I mean, it's a form of art. Or go to Steam and see, because what Steam do, and they have charity branches, like, there's a lot of things going on.
It's like they were sold as toys in the 80s and the 90s, but nobody, like, really thought that they were always going to be toys. Everybody, like, really thought.
What, games? Electronic games.
In general, right? Mm. Like, they initially were sold as toys.
Well, people don't realize the impact of any. It's past 115. It's past $115 billion a year industry, first of all.
Larger than the movie industry.
It's larger than any form of entertainment, even global sports, unless you add merchandising.
Right.
Hmm. Not soccer. All sports on planet Earth are smaller than all electronic games on planet Earth. And of course, let's not forget, a lot of people sadly have absolutely no, they're talking about finding clean water, not low ping rates, yes? Definitely first world problem here. But the other thing that a lot of people don't see is the cultural impact. It's basically dominating the culture. All the artists, the musicians, all the cool kids, if you will, they're in one way, even if they don't play they write poetry in play universes. You know, I mean, it's so everywhere. Literature now, right? I mean, a student actually corrected me. The whole fan fiction world is, you know, the first time actually some of the publishers are looking at the fan fiction as bigger monetary opportunity than the original writer. Imagine a world in which actually the real money is not in Harry Potter, it's in the fan fiction about Harry Potter, right? And further, actually, 50 Shades of Grey, apparently, a book I haven't read, a movie I haven't seen.
Didn't she just get, the author, didn't they?
That's
get
a fan
sued?
Fiction.
Right.
It's originally a fan fiction, very far removed from its
original. Somebody in Texas just got, well, it was like yesterday, the day before, they just got a huge ruling. They won like $65 or $75 million from the publisher.
For, hmm? 60 sh- for
50 Shades of Grey, yeah, for like copyright infringement.
You know, really? And I wonder if that, and I don't know specifically about that at all. But
yeah,
I mean,
you can
somebody
Google
told
it, though, yeah.
But there's a humongous community. That's where the creative kids are, honestly, you know? And the sophistication of the indie games.
Like, clearly with Star Wars, you know? Like, Star Wars, I'm a big Star Wars fan. And like you see, like, I will never finish
Star Trek.
The Star Wars.
Historically,
series.
I believe it's Star Trek that started the whole fan thing, which is a little odd.
I'm not
sometimes.
Claiming Star Wars started it. I'm just saying, like, hey, it's really visible there, level. You know, where you have all sorts of novels.
So Marvel and DC, if I recall, hopefully one of our listeners out there is enough of a comic nerd.
We have an in-house global expert.
I believe DC was originally started as fan fiction based on Marvel.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So now, I mean, you know, upcoming movies, Batman versus Superman, which is DC. I mean, that's basically the result of fan fiction from decades ago.
I'm impressed, Corey.
And hey, people, it's older than that. In fact, you know, hey, let's do a plug here. You know, Charlotte and me are organizing a big conference in the early June here.
That's
at Orleans,
right.
And it's all about that. I mean, the conference is the humanities. It's kind of about French 17th century literature is the kind of scholarship side of it. But the whole theme is how we live in an era that is remarkably similar in so many ways to the transformative era of the late 17th century, early 18th century. So it's like the beginning of modernity. End of modernity. You know? So 17th century is the late 17th century, early 18th century is kind of the most relevant era for us to look around. And honestly, as a kind of, that insight didn't come to me from reading like scholarship. This came from me for hanging with my kids on fan. And then Charlotte and me, we actually started teaching this method and published a couple of papers about it. So this notion of like, how do you explain this to people? How do you explain the 17th century to people? It seems so dusty and remote. No. Send them to make a fan fiction site for their class, and then they'll get it, you know, because that's how they wrote back then in salon, etc., etc. So that's one of the themes that we're going to explore. So this technological era is interesting, but it's hard to see close by. You know, we don't see even technically the effects, by the way. Finally, and then we'll call it the top of the hour and catch my breath and come back. But interface design, many of the ways everybody, grandmas now are using Facebook, you know, I mean, it's all forums, everything. The gamers had to figure out a way with technological constraints to push a tremendous amount of information effectively at users. So the interface designs of the games of 10 years ago are now the cutting-edge web portal that you use for your health insurance. You know,
to pay your taxes.
Not as good as that forum 10 years ago, but still, yeah.
Long live the tax.
So anyway, I mean, it's elephant in the room still, despite being so huge, I think.
Sounds good to me.
And no, in Steam, don't pay me anything. I'm purely... actually, I pay them a lot when you come to think about it.
Yeah. All right, folks. So you've been listening to Punkonomics here, broadcasting live from WPRK, yeah. Winter Park, Florida. The best in basement radio.
Dead Souls. This is sort of a film idea loosely suggested by...